This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the cartoonist Michael Heath. For 60 years, his sharpened nib and equally pointed wit have satirised the bumptious, hypocritical and contradictory behaviour of, well, all of us. High Court judges, punk rockers, schoolchildren, politicians, young mums, shopkeepers, city gents, hipsters, all have, at one time or another, been skewered by the pithy concision of his pen. He's brought humour to the pages of virtually every British newspaper there is, and he's currently cartoon editor of The Spectator. Born in the mid-1930s, his schooling throughout the war years was virtually non-existent. By the age of 12, he still couldn't read and write, and as a student, he claims to have hated every minute of art college, but the fact remains that it was drawing that ended up connecting him to the rest of the world. He says the idea of being a cartoonist came because I could draw silly things. I couldn't read or write, but I could communicate with cartoons. So welcome, Michael Heath. You sounded there in the middle of that introduction as if you wanted to contradict me.
Now, you're completely correct. The reason I did draw, I suppose, was because that I really couldn't read or write, and I could sort of scribble little drawings down, and I sort of wanted to do that. My father was a cartoonist of children's comics, film fun, radio fun. They weren't humorous, cowboys and Indians, and detective stories and things like that. And he hated every moment of it. He was a teacher once upon a time, but he gave it up and became an illustrator of children's comics, which paid much better than being a teacher. So I think before the war, he was earning up to £30 a week, when the average wage was about fourpence. But he learned to hate it, and they worked him into the ground. The only reason I'm bringing this up is because I was surrounded by people who my mother could draw too, and illustrate little drawings for the picture goer. And the way they talked about that work, and the way he hated it, and it ruined his life, he thought, the last thing I should have become was what I became, a cartoonist.
We're living in a particularly tumultuous and fascinating time politically. I'm wondering if that makes for very rich pickings for a cartoonist.
Well, it does, unless it's the one at the moment, because they're going through all this nonsense of changing government and all the rest of it, and then it goes on and on and on and on, and they take over everything, and the air goes out of everything, and there's nothing else, and there's no action in no other show in town other than politicians. And I'm not mad about being a political cartoonist. I do sort of everything. I satirise. I'm not sure about the word even satire, but the thing is that I draw what I see around me, and I never thought of that as a particularly clever thing to do, but I thought it was a way that your drawings wouldn't date. So if you got the hair right and the clothes right and on people or whatever, then you wouldn't date.
If I may say so, you yourself don't appear to have dated. I knew from my notes that you were born in 1935, so you're 80. You walked in here today. If anybody had asked me, I would have said, tops 62 years old. You look very current.
How can I answer that? I said, yes, I'm wonderful. You know, I've got wonderful skin.
I'm actually talking about what you're wearing.
You're wearing?
You're a sharp-dressed man.
Well, that's a desperate attempt to seem young and tragic. And
well, it's working.
I haven't had a facelift.
Not the tragic bit, the young.
No, no.
So what are we going to hear? And why have you chosen this, track number one?
I was working at 1953... training to be an animator in J. Arthur Rank's studios, and I wanted to be an animator, and I wanted to animate things like Bambi, I suppose. Things like that. Anyway, I was animating advertisements at 24 drawings per second of movement. Anyway, I hated it. And the man in charge of the place was an American, one-legged American gay man who chain-smoked, and he came into the studio one day, threw this record at me, and it was this EP, I think. And I took it home, put it on my dad's record player, and my hair, which I still have, as you're kind enough to say, is not a wig, stood on end. I really was flipped, as they say, and I was, boom, and I went, wow. And I thought Thelonious Monk was the greatest thing I'd ever heard in my life, and I had heard lots of music. Thank you.
Chris Cross, played by Thelonious Monk on piano with Art Blakey, Milt Jackson, Al McKibben and Sahib Shihab. You said, Michael Heath, that made the hairs on the back of your neck stand up on end when you heard it. Does it still?
Well, I played him pretty well every day since then. Having heard Thelonious Monk, I loved it so much that I thought I'd draw like that. And I thought that I could do that somehow, keep the drawings fresh. And remember, the track then lasted 3 minutes, so you were in and out of the record. Later on, it became LPs, and they went on forever, and jazz became boring, and then became avant-garde jazz, which sounded like fire in a pet shop music. And I liked the wit of Thelonious Monk and the speed of which they played, and we were all hopelessly, terrifically professional and amazingly... You could not copy him, and I thought that was something.
Is it your aim, when they look at a piece of one of your cartoons, is it your aim to make them laugh out loud and move on swiftly, or do you want them to smile and think?
I want them to buy it. I have no idea, other than the fact that I have a morbid fear of boring everyone witless, and hopefully they will get the joke.
Pretty recently, 2015, there was the appalling incident in the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. 12 people were killed, targeted because of the cartoons that were being drawn by the magazine depicting the Prophet Muhammad. How much do you think cartoonists should be concerned about offending people's sensibilities?
Well, there's a limit what you can do. I mean, now if you can't draw certain things and you can be killed by it, I mean, it adds a certain friction to your drawing. However, I'm not that sort of cartoonist. I try to keep you amused, like laughing or telling jokes in the air raid shelter.
Are there, for example, areas that you would not stray into? You think, I don't want to cover this or that with my drawings? Are there things you've been told not to cover because they might offend people?
No, there are cartoonists, not necessarily guys who want to be funny, but the idea is you should upset people. The whole thing about... say, political cartoonists, they should be so outrageous that everyone would, you know, questions in the house about the drawing yesterday in The Guardian or whatever. That was not my thing. I'm copped out. I wanted to be what I am, which is funny. Funny is now dangerous, and you've got to be careful what you do, because the whole groups of people who take offence all the time, who look to take offence, who wish to take offence, and they take offence at whatever you do.
So then are you careful not to do it?
No, I do it. I really do it, but they don't get it, so it doesn't matter.
Let's have some more music. Michael Heath, tell me about your second one. What are we going to hear?
It's Dance of the Infidels, Bud Powell, another brilliant pianist, technically terrific and amazing and mad, unfortunately, and driven that way by heroin, as most of them were at that period. I saw him once. I went to Paris and saw him. And he sat in front of the piano and didn't move at all, didn't play. There's a bass player and a drummer. And they pulled down a light over him and turned it on and off, and he started playing. If you're depressed or feeling sad or whatever it is, or I put him on. Bud Powell has a boom, and it killed him doing that. I mean, the guys who did this sort of thing invariably blew themselves away, let alone us. These people inspired me to carry on churning out drawing. But I'm a hack. I mean, there's no other way for it. I'm just a hack cartoonist who happens to still be alive in a world which cartooning is in dire straits, I think.
That was Dance of the Infidels, played by Bud Powell, accompanied there by Percy Heath and Kenny Clarke. So, Michael Heath, you were born in London, unlikely as it may seem, in 1935. What are your earliest childhood memories?
Mine's sort of blank up until the war starts, really. I can't remember much about it, though we did live in Hampstead, around Museum Street. And I was a Londoner born in the sound of Bow Bells, what are you supposed to do?
And your dad, as you were mentioning, your dad was an illustrator.
Yeah, my father's upstairs chewing the furniture because he doesn't like drawing cowboys and Indians, even though he's brilliant at it. And my mother was a mother of 1939. My mother was a dear soul, and so was my father. But I had no relationship with my parents at all, and that was normal, I gather. I mean, my father did not hug me, we did not high-five, and we did not get together and go out together and laugh like drains watching whatever football. I was sort of thrown out of the house at 8 a.m. and told to come back at 6, and that's the way it was.
And can you tell me more about your mother? You say she was a typical mother of, you know, of the time.
Was a dear soul and played the piano at ragtime, and I thought that was lovely. And I just,
and did she draw too?
I mean, she did a few drawings for Picture Gower and stopped and never drew again, except the odd card for somebody and things like that. No, she didn't do it. But the house was full of pictures and, you know, the prints of Van Gogh and things like that. And my father was an intellectual. Intellectuals, as we were living in Hampstead at that time, were all communists, Stalinists, and all hated Churchill, which seemed a bit odd to me, but I didn't question it. But living in Hampstead, one came across all these intellectuals, and that mean tweed suits and open-toed sandals and a beard and a pipe. My father was in charge of the National Fire Service, which meant that he had to gather enough people, locals around his neighbours, to put out incendiary bombs that were dropped.
And you used to help him with that, didn't you?
I did, yes, indeed. The incendiary bombs were often dropped too low and didn't blow up and were just lying around all over Hampstead Heath. And I was asked if I'd help out and load them up in a pub at the bottom of Downshire Hill. And they were piled up like milk bottles. And I used to go out and collect all these things and carry them like milk bottles. And I remember an old lady seeing me and fainting. I thought it was very funny. And then I got to the bottom of the road and they'd pile them up. No, health and safety didn't come into it. Early war years to me, I had some friends and all the rest of it. It was, unfortunately, it sounds awful, but I mean, it seemed fun.
It's time for some more music. Tell me about your third. What are we going to hear now?
Well, poor things out there who've heard some jazz are probably lying down or whatever it is and don't want to hear any more jazz ever again. So I'm playing what you might like a little better. It's the Teddy Bear's Picnic. I said I didn't particularly talk to my parents and they not to me. And we didn't celebrate birthdays or Christmas or anything like that or give presents to each other. But I had a friend all the time in the background, and that was the BBC. BBC radio was going on all the time. And Lord Reith saw to it, very brilliantly, I thought, is that he'd have a comedy programme and he'd follow it with Beethoven's Fifth or whatever, and the children's programmes, which I used to hear occasionally. I thought it was brilliant.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day the teddy bears have their pick. Pick.
That was Teddy Bear's Picnic, performed by Val Rosen with Henry Hall and his orchestra. You were laughing, was it ruefully, throughout that?
Well, I was just thinking about, I suppose there were, the children it was aimed at were of age between whatever it was, 3 and 8. Wouldn't be the same children as they are now.
You said no Christmas presents, no birthday presents. I mean, your father was earning a living. Was that part of the sort of communist ethos that, you know, don't...
I don't think. He gave the same present to my mother every year, but didn't cheer her up. He gave a little bottle of violet perfume, which she said was disgusting. And he never varied that. And what presents I was given at that time, perhaps a teddy or something like that, or an old train, they were taken away from me and given to the people next door or something, had been bombed out. Or indeed, I didn't know my birthday or what date it was on. I once, at a school I was in for 5 minutes, invited a lot of kids in the school that I was in the classroom with. I said that my birthday was on such and such a date, and they must turn up with presents or something like that. Anyway, they turned up. And it wasn't my birthday, and they were sent away. And I hid behind the settee. So, I mean,
it's tragicomic, that story. I mean, you're laughing. I want to sort of shed a tear about it.
The tears of a clown. Yes, I can see that. Yes, it's ghastly. But, of course, it may be...
Well, is it not a bit ghastly? It sounds a bit ghastly. You've mentioned that your dad was an ARP warden in Hampstead. You had during the war also been sent for a time to Devon, where your grandmother lived, because it was meant to be safer there.
Yes,
how did that go?
I was evacuated. I mean, not in the colourful way of standing around with a box with a gas mask in it. I was at Waterloo Station or whatever it was. And I went to stay with my grandmother. I was on the beach one day. It was very difficult because they covered it in scaffolding and laid bombs all over the bloody place.
And this was in Devon?
Yes, a place called Tor Cross. I climbed through the scaffolding and barbed wire. It was a lovely day. And I sat there on the beach, and there were a few people around me, not a couple of soldiers, and they saw the aeroplanes coming towards us. And they said, "Ah, they're two of ours." And I said, "Wee," like that. They separated, machine gunned us all and cannon fired us all. And I didn't know anything other than to run. So I got up and ran and climbed through the barbed wire and the scaffolding. And all this noise around, I couldn't figure out what it was like. And it was shrapnel. And, you know, they'd bombed the place, and it was considered more dangerous to be in Devon than it was to be in London, so I came back to London.
Tell me about your next piece of music, Michael Heath. We're on your fourth of the day.
Oh, Max Miller. Max Miller. In 1947, my father, for reasons never quite understood, dragged us all out of London and took us to live in Brighton. We stayed there. Now, Brighton, in 1947... was pretty well exactly as it is in Graham Greene, Brighton Rock. And it was absolutely the most fantastic thing. And the whole town was like a frontier town. I mean, it's just outrageous, full of criminals on the run from the police. Nowadays, you get away from the police, you go to Rio or something. In those days, they got trained Victoria and went to Brighton for 15 shillings or something, return. And I would take to this club and I met all these criminals and strange men and odd women.
Let's hear it.
And there was a fella running down the street in his shirt. That's all he had on, a little tiny shirt, running down the street. I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Home. Here." Here's a song that goes with it. "I never slept a wink all night."
That was Max Miller at the Finsbury Park Empire in 1942. Max in an air raid, and "I never slept a wink all night." Michael Heath, you were mentioning there that your father, for, as you say, unknown reasons, took the family to Brighton in 1947. So much of your work is filled with this brilliant, luxurious detail, the small bits of life. If you were to pen a little cartoon snapshot of life in Brighton at that time, in the, let's say, the early 50s, what would be in it?
With the mixture of people, the criminals and the things that they did to each other, and I mean, I got a job, in the club, there was a billiard hall upstairs and they gave me a shilling to go out and get them sandwiches because often they go into mammoth card games, which would last 24 hours. And every now and then they'd beat someone up.
You ended up at art school and you, am I right, you did lose every minute of it?
Nobody did any work. I mean, they just sat around talking about Gide or something. And I wanted to go out and I wanted to freelance and I did it there. I mean, I was freelancing there and I sold my first drawing to Melody Maker magazine, which is my jazz thing, jazz magazine, a very good one. And I sent them some drawings and I sold them straight away. I got two guineas. I didn't do captions then. I just did amusing drawings or Christmas cards or something like that. Or indeed, there was a funny office in London for Decca Records when the LP first came out. And you would sit in a room and a guy would open a hole in the wall and say, "Debussy, anyone know anything about Debussy? Do a cover, £10. And I said, "Jazz, anyone know anything about jazz?" "I do, sir." "Okay, £10, here he is, do it."
Quite a good living, actually. I mean, that's not bad.
Well, it could, yes, it was a good living, I mean, and it's very good. And then I eventually ended up in a newspaper that everyone's forgotten about, The Woman's Sunday Mirror. And I did a strip called Nelly Know-All, Never Throw Anything Out, Make Do and Mend. And, you know, don't throw those old socks away. Dye them and then hang them up for Christmas or eat them boiled. And I got £10, 10 shillings for that.
Let's fit in some more music, Michael Heath. Tell me what we're going to hear now. This is your fifth track of the morning.
Jack Buchanan. Not jazz. Honestly, I swear to God out there that you're probably leaving the room, but it's not jazz, I said to you. Jack Buchanan, I suppose, is Britain's answer to Fred Astaire. And these are pre-electric recordings that I've been listening to, and this one is one too. And they have to project themselves, you know, they have to sell a song and all the rest of it. It is relentlessly cheerful, and it's about travelling, for God's sake. Well, I mean, travelling now is horrendous, but this is about travelling, and travelling in 1929 was obviously, you know, about three people going to Paris, like for £3 or something like that, and or sitting in one aeroplane and being given cocktails. And it has that boom, Joy V thing, like Cheerful Charlie Chaplin or whatever, or someone who wishes to entertain you and not go...
Let's hear it, shall we?
I've been a while away from Beck to Mendeley. No buses ever ran for me. And I have crossed the line and roamed the wide world over. And I have even seen down under and over. And I have found the milk of human kindness too, way back in Buffalo and cows. You take a step, I take a step, keep on and stop.
Take a Step, Jack Buchanan with the Shaftesbury Theatre Orchestra, directed there by Thomas Tunbridge. You were well embedded into Fleet Street, Michael Heath, by the 1960s, working for Punch, The Spectator, Private Eye and so on. You were also part of a rather, is louche a good word, that Soho drinking crowd. You know, people like Geoffrey Bernard and Lucian Freud and Francis Bacon. Yes, are you still?
Yes.
Little bit.
Well, I can't do the drinking I drank, or drank the drink I'm drinking, whatever it is. As I'd been in Brighton and I'd met all these strange people, odd balls, as you would call them, and I'm in Soho, I came across or was introduced to Geoffrey Bernard, who's outrageous and a wonderful writer for The Spectator. And I got on extremely well with him, although he was outrageously rude, and so were all his friends. But they were all witty and amusing and clever. And they all were brilliant painters, Francis Bacon, for instance, and Lucian Freud, and all these other strange people. All of them had one thing in common. On the whole, they had something that you wanted to hear or pick up from. And no one was allowed to boast, and you mustn't talk about money you'd earned or whatever it is, or a drawing, anything like that. You just sat down and or stood and listened to what they had to say. And it was, I mean, just boom. I thought it was the most amazing thing in the world. Francis Bacon was the most frightening man I've ever come across. I think it was terrific.
Yes, you once said it was like drinking with panthers.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure you should say that or not, but the thing is, yes.
did you bother to wonder where the sort of self-destructiveness and the general destructiveness of that group of people came from? Because it sounds like a very visceral environment.
Well, for a start, the pub closed at 2, and then you went up to the Colony Room after drinking in the French or Coach and Horses in Soho, and then went back to the pub.
And it was whiskey was the drink of choice?
Whiskey was the thing then, yeah. We drank, well, vodka or whiskey, yeah, lots of it. You start the day with Geoffrey Bernard, perhaps, in the Coach and Horses. And
what sort of time?
Well, 11. And Geoffrey would be coughing something dreadful. He'd be smoking 50 senior service a day and all the rest of it, and drinking God knows what.
If you were in the pub at 11, when were you doing the cartooning? When were you doing the drawing?
When I was drinking. Both.
Were you? So you could be productive.
I could drink and draw.
That's something of a problem, isn't it? If one is still able to do one's work.
So I thought it was rather good. I mean, after all, you draw fearlessly when you're drunk or half drunk, and it sort of gives you a sort of whiz.
You designed the set for Keith Waterhouse's play, Geoffrey Bernard is Unwell.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a terrific and huge hit. And as you say, he was doing this weekly column called Low Life for The Spectator, which Jonathan Meads, the cultural commentator, once said was a suicide note in weekly instalments.
Correct.
Yes. Does that seem about right by your estimation?
I was accused of not having, as Geoffrey would say, guts. You got no guts. Guts meant drinking continually. I mean, and not stopping. Every day, all day, until you dropped or whatever. Serious drinking. I mean, I always said, you know, I made my excuses and left. I was a coward. I never went off. I went off to work. I never wanted to die of it.
Let's have some more music, Michael Heath. Tell me about what we're going to hear next. It's your sixth of the day.
Well, this is one of the many brilliant recordings that played by Bud Powell, and it's All the Things You Are. Jazz at Massey Hall, Bud Powell, Max Roach and Charlie Parker.
And why do you like it?
Because you can't repeat it, nobody else can do it, nobody could do it. These members are so brilliant that they played anyone else off the stage, as you couldn't play like any of them.
All the Things You Are, Dizzy Gillespie, Charles Mingus, Charlie Parker, Bud Powell and Max Roach there. Michael Heath, you once did a marvellous cartoon of a man at a bar saying to a woman he's chatting up, "Do I know you from somewhere?" And she says, "We were married for 5 years."
Oh, God, there was lots of them, yes. Did jokes about marriage and all the rest of it. And I did this for The Guardian, of all things. And
yes, then... it was the early 80s. You had that cartoon strip called Love All.
Oh, and God, yes.
To say it was darkly humorous doesn't really cover it.
Well, it was
a bit bitter and twisted, wasn't it?
Racked with guilt, I say.
Would it be fair to conclude that you are not a romantic?
I'm the most romantic man you ever met in your life.
Is that true?
I'm completely soppy. Absolutely, completely, absolutely, certifiably, mentally soppy. If you show me Bambi, I'm on the floor sobbing. Dumbo.
I don't know if you're toying with me now. Is this true? Are you romantic?
Absolutely the truth.
And so you've been married twice.
Yes, indeed, twice. Long time. Well, yeah, but I mean, now it's heroic. I mean, a long time. I've been married, I think, 24 years, first one, I think, and 18 years, the other one, and one in the middle I didn't marry.
So long marriages. I mean, you said you're a romantic, you've said you're neurotic. Did work tend to always take precedence?
I've got to be careful how I phrase this. The thing is, first of all, women may become attracted to you because you make them laugh. And they say, "Oh, I love his drawings. This is super." I do little drawings with them. And then you get married to them. Editor says, "I want this drawing by 5. And you've got to do it by 5. And they say, "I thought we were going out. I thought we were going to the theatre or cinema or whatever it is." And I say, "I've got to do this drawing, get it in." And I said, "Well, why don't you ring the editor up and say you haven't got time, you're going out?"
That doesn't seem the most unreasonable idea.
Well... No, but, I mean, there are 3 people in a marriage with a cartoonist. The cartoonists are not funny, necessarily. You know, they're not giggling or laughing. I mean, the sad side of it, the depression side of it, because I don't think there's any fun without you being depressed at the same time. You've got to know the difference between the two. I mean, depression is the adverse side of people giggling all the time.
Of course, everybody is familiar with the idea that we have, you know, professional obligations. But for everybody, there's a choice to be made. You know, you might say, "Well, actually, today is the day that I do phone the editor and say it."
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was driven, darling. You know, if I was a composer or if I was Shostakovich or whatever, I mean, everyone would allow me to go up there and hammer away and conduct a huge orchestra and miss dates and God knows what else and like that. And they would naturally assume that came first, and you were the greatest composer of all time, or conductor, or a great artist, for instance. Art and me, I mean, you know, I'm not an artist, I'm a cartoonist, and I'm rather angry about that, because if I played my cards right, I wouldn't have to think of these damned ideas all the time, because every day it's like going in for a competition and having to win. If I'd become a contemporary British artist, I wouldn't have had to do anything. So you took a blank canvas up, and then rude word in neon written backwards, and everyone says, "Stunning."
I get the feeling that Michael Heath on contemporary art might be a whole new series, but I don't think we have time for it here.
And I admire them, you understand. I don't go and laugh or sneer at them. I wish I was one.
Tell me about your next piece of music. We're on your 7th, Michael Heath.
Funny Face, Fred Astaire and his sister. It's rather like Jack Buchanan, and we recorded at much the same time, and you had to shout into a tube to get yourself heard on an old shellac record. And that adds to me something about it. It's like you got no chance of retakes or anything like that. You've got to do it in 3 minutes and out. And Fred Astaire's full of beans and excitement. And I defy you not to feel happier after you've heard Funny Face.
From having you around, though you're no Gloria Swanson, for worlds I'd not replace that funny, funny face.
Needn't tell me that I'm not so pretty, dear, when my looking glass and I agree. In the contest at Atlantic City, dear, Miss America I'd never be.
That was Funny Face by George and Ira Gershwin, sung there by Fred and Adele Astaire with Julian Jones and his orchestra. Michael Heath, I'm hesitant to call it a body of work, and yet it is. And I'm only hesitant because you yourself have said, "Well, I'm just a hack cartoonist who happens to be alive," which is to rather underplay the whole thing.
There's no other way of working for newspapers other than working at great speed and also magazines. So you had to be on the ball and know what you were doing. And
do you take time to go back and look at it? Do you leaf through old copies?
No, I don't, other than the fact that I do like what I did, but I didn't like doing what I did it, and I don't like what I do now when I do it. But if I look at it 6 months from now or 6 years from now, I think, my God, I wish I could draw like that now.
Cartooning, of course, has always relied on print as a medium. It is now a declining medium. Do you think there is a danger that as print as a medium declines, we will see the decline of cartoonists?
Yeah, I mean, it is true, because you can, if you want to save money, you can get rid of cartoonists quite easily, because they never come out of their hole in the wall. They stay at home and churn it out, and their wives are saying, what are you doing? You're boring, and so on. But the fact is that there are no cartoons in newspapers as they once were. The only cartooning that exists healthily is political cartoonists, and all the broadsheets have a political cartoonist.
You go into the office 5 days a week, is that right, at the Spectator?
Yeah, well, I did work at home. I wouldn't recommend it.
Why do you go into the office now? What is it about that? Is that a creative environment? Is it contact with other people that stimulates?
Well, I come across other people who are alive and chatty and all the rest of it, and I pick up on things very quickly. Also, it stimulates me, and going to work stimulates me. It makes me very angry being on the underground and being with rude people, but that's the name of the game. I say, OK, I put it in a drawing, you know, I mean, I get my own back.
It sounds to me like you might actually quite like being alone on an island, because, of course, I'm going to cast you away today. Do you quite like the idea?
I quite like it, I guess, because, you know, I'm used to being on my own, and when you're divorced, you're living in horrible rooms and all the rest of it, and I have a friend, a dog, who's been with me all the time, Charlie Parker. Can I take the dog on the desert island?
This we will come to in a second. But first, right. Tell me about your final piece of music. What are we going to hear now? What's your eighth track?
We got some more jazz here. That's Charlie Parker. That's my dog. And I just love this record. There are thousands of tracks that I'd love to have played and bored you rigid with, but I love this one. And it's Lover by Charlie Parker.
Thank you. That was Lover, played by Charlie Parker, composed by Richard Rodgers and Lorenz Hart. It comes to the point, Michael Heath, when I give you some books, you get the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and you get to take one other book along with them. What's your book going to be?
Diary of a Nobody. It was serialised in Punch, turn of the century. It's about a family, lived in Clapham or somewhere, and it's hysterical. It hasn't aged at all.
We'll give that to you then. And a luxury too. What would your luxury be?
I'd have a painting kit so I can learn to paint properly, and I'd have a critic fly over and then review it. It's a stunning drawing, the painting, the colour in the corner and the neon sign written backwards saying bum.
Right.
And then I'd be a real artist and I'd be able to dig my own grave and end nicely at sea,
right.
Buried at sea.
We'll give you that then. And which one disc of the eight would you save if you had to save one?
Crisscross. The first one, Thelonious Monk.
We shall give you Crisscross. Michael Heath, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Terrific. I'm now off to go and do a gag about God knows what. I haven't the foggiest idea, but it's about something.
Good luck with that.
Toodle-pip.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.